Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in the next half hour, we're going to continue with our discussion about German corporate control over American publishing, focusing, in addition to the, well, in this broadcast, we're going to focus primarily on the Bertelsmann company. Don't forget the von Holtzbrinck firm, about which we have spoken in the past. Other broadcasts dealing with this subject, either in part or whole, for the record, segment 122, 123, 135, 152, 177, and this is for the record program 189. One of the things that we covered in the past was the fact that the Bertelsmann company, the dominant, one of the largest media companies in the world, and one of the companies that effectively controls American publishing, has bought 50% of BarnesandNoble.com. Now, BarnesandNoble.com is in a joint venture with Microsoft for online books. The New York Times of Friday, January 7th of the year 2000, has the following story by Doreen Carvajal, C-A-R-V-A-J-A-L. It's headlined, Microsoft in a Publishing Pact with BarnesandNoble.com, and this reads as follows, reads in part as follows. In another step to nurture the infant market for electronic books, the Microsoft Corporation and the online bookseller BarnesandNoble.com said yesterday that they would create a bookstore offering thousands of digital titles that can be read on new Microsoft software. Executives for both companies discussed the venture at a Las Vegas Consumer Electronics trade show, confidently predicting that paperless books could eventually revolutionize publishing. But they have yet to identify any major American consumer trade publishers that have agreed to make titles available in that format. BarnesandNoble.com, the electronic retailing arm of the Barnes & Noble bookstore chain, signed agreements with Microsoft to develop an electronic bookstore on its existing website by the spring. The outlet is to offer a mix of classics and new works, fewer than 10,000 titles in all, that could be read on electronic devices or personal computers. Again, Bertelsmann owns 50% of BarnesandNoble.com. Recently, much of the world's attention has been focused on AOL's purchase of Time Warner. Time Warner had been the largest media corporation in the world. Bertelsmann was number three. I would note that not only does Bertelsmann have capital participation in America Online, at least they did until very recently, but Bertelsmann also is in a joint venture with America Online because AOL Europe is a joint AOL and Bertelsmann operation. New York Times of Tuesday, January 11th of the year 2000 has the following story by Edmund L. Andrews. It's subtitled The Europeans at headline, Takeover May Increase U.S. Cultural Dominance of the Web on the Continent. Stateline Frankfurt, January 10th, and reads in part as follows. Skipping down, here in Europe, America Online's prospective takeover of Time Warner is likely to accentuate that phenomenon and increase pressure among rivals for alliances and mergers. America Online and Bertelsmann AG of Germany are partners in AOL Europe, which operates local language networks across the continent. So note that Bertelsmann has its firm in has its finger in AOL, and also has capital participation as well. At least they did. There was some talk of them selling it. I don't believe that has happened, but I may be wrong. And recall that in the first half hour of this particular program, we discussed a Bertelsmann venture with Time Warner, now purchased by AOL. Reprising this, New York Times, Tuesday, December 14th of 1999, another article by Doreen Carvajal headlined, Two book club giants are said to be poised to join forces. Less than a year and a half after buying the nation's premier publishing house, the Bertelsmann media conglomerate is poised to form a partnership with an American icon of popular literature, the Book of the Month Club unit of Time, Incorporated. Bertelsmann, which is based in Gütersloh, Germany, and purchased Random House last year, is negotiating to create a joint venture that could bring together the two largest book clubs in the United States, the Book of the Month Club and Bertelsmann's Literary Guild, according to publishing executives who insist on remaining anonymous. Skipping down, the companies have made tentative plans to create a six-member board presiding over the joint venture that will be evenly divided between executives of Bertelsmann and Time Warner, Time Incorporated's corporate parents. And note that in both AOL and Time Warner, Bertelsmann figures in this new giant media corporation. They have joint ventures with both AOL and Time Warner. Although AOL owns Time Warner for the time being, many American corporations have a current accounts deficit. It remains to be seen what happens when the American speculative bubble goes bust. What we're going to do next is a reprise of section from For the Record segment 123. That was part two of the series about American corporate control over American publishing. And what we're going to do is to listen to the Nazi past of Bertelsmann, but beyond that, note here the SS background of Heinrich Mohn. He is the sort of patron of the firm, the fellow who built it into the giant corporation that it became prior to and during World War II. And in turn, we're going to be excerpting, in addition to For the Record segment 123, we're going to be excerpting an article called Bertelsmann's Nazi Past. This was published in The Nation magazine of December 28th of 1998. The article was co-authored by Hirsch Fischler and John Friedman. And after discussing Bertelsmann's role as the supplier of books, the largest supplier of books for the Wehrmacht and the SS, the article then goes on to describe the SS background of Heinrich Mohn, the firm's patron, and also the background of his son, Reinhard Mohn, who recently stepped down as head of Bertelsmann. This again is excerpted from For the Record segment 123 and The Nation magazine of December 28th of 1998.
Continuing. When Bertelsmann applied after the war for a second publishing license, it was turned down by occupation authorities. Mohn had forgotten, unquote, to mention that he had been a, quote, passive, unquote, member of the SS, as well as a supporter of the Hitler Youth, and a member of the prestigious National Socialist Flying Corps, according to denazification files in the Central State Archive in Dusseldorf. Note here that Heinrich Mohn, the head of the company, was a, quote, passive, unquote, member of the SS, according to his own description. That sounds rather like, to me personally, Bill Clinton's equivocation concerning having had sex with Monica Lewinsky. He doesn't consider oral sex to constitute sex. I certainly don't think that's an impeachable offense. But again, the concept of a passive member of the SS appears to me to be Clinton-esque in its originality and an exercise in equivocation under the circumstances. I never heard of a passive member of the SS, and it reminds me, going back to the Clinton-Lewinsky situation, reminds me of a Russian observer's comment that, quote, if the Americans don't think oral sex is constitutes sex, they're not doing it right, unquote. There were no passive members of the SS. This is simply foolishness. He may not have actually killed people with his bare hands, but the SS was anything but a passive organization. Continuing. In 1947, Bertelsmann wrote to the Allied authorities that because of illness and age, Mohn, then 62, was leaving as manager to be replaced by his son, Reinhard Mohn, who immediately and successfully applied for the license. Reinhard Mohn, who currently controls the majority voting power of Bertelsmann, was born in 1921. He served in the Luftwaffe according to denazification files. His vitae on a Bertelsmann website states that he was in the Afrika Corps. Der Spiegel reported he was in the elite Hermann Göring Division. I have seen references to the Hermann Göring Division as a Waffen-SS division. I don't know if that is accurate or not. But in any event, it's worth noting that whether it was SS or no, Reinhard Mohn was a member of an elite German military unit, the Hermann Göring Division. By the way, Licio Gelli was a liaison officer to that same division. And note that Heinrich Mohn, the head of the Bertelsmann firm, was SS.
That again from The Nation magazine of December 28th of 1998, an article by Hirsch Fischler and John Friedman, Bertelsmann's Nazi Past. By the way, the Hermann Göring Division, I heard the reference to that as Waffen-SS on the Internet. That's incorrect. The Hermann Göring Division was a Luftwaffe division, but it was nonetheless an elite Nazi division. And an indication of Reinhard Mohn's significance, not only within the German industrial hierarchy, but also in relation to the Bormann Group that I've spoken about so often. The Bormann Group, by the way, is the economic component, literally the economic component, of a Third Reich gone underground. Bormann, Martin Bormann, Hitler's vice chancellor, and really the power behind the throne in the Third Reich, set up 750 corporate fronts in partnership with the major German corporations, and the liquid wealth of the Third Reich was transferred out to those 750 corporate fronts in neutral nations to then be returned to the major corporations of Germany to help restore Germany's economic power. And to this day, all of the German major corporations are linked to the Bormann Group, and the major decisions in German industrial and economic matters are made by the Bormann Group, according to Paul Manning, discussed on the other side of this particular program. We're going to take a brief look now at a book that we looked at in connection with For the Record segments 122 and 123. That book is called Global Dreams, subtitled Imperial Corporations and the New World Order. The book was co-authored by Richard J. Barnett and John Cavanaugh, published in hardcover by Simon & Schuster, copyright 1994. And in this book, there's discussion of Reinhard Mohn and the fact that Dieter Vogel, his protege, was basically maneuvered into the position of heading up the Thyssen Industrial Group. And if a Reinhard Mohn protege became head of the Thyssen Group, one of the most important elements not only in the German heavy industrial situation, but also with regard to the Bormann Group, that is an indication of where Reinhard Mohn basically is located vis-a-vis the Bormann Group and German industry. Of Dieter Vogel's status as Reinhard Mohn's protege, and then Dieter Vogel's ascension to the head of the Thyssen Group, we read, Gerd Schulte-Hillen is a sophisticated worldly man who speaks several European languages. He started in the company as a young man, ran the company's printing operation in Spain, and quickly became one of Reinhard Mohn's proteges, along with Mark Vosner, the chief executive officer, and Dieter Vogel, now the head of the great Thyssen industrial complex. And the Thyssen Group also had much to do with arming Saddam Hussein as well. Note that the Thyssen Group and the Thyssen family are very close to the Bormann Group and the Bormann family. The relationship between Martin Bormann and old Fritz Thyssen began in 1923. A year later, George Herbert Walker, the great-grandfather of George W. and the grandfather of the former president and one of Hitler's most important American financial backers, he formed a relationship with Fritz Thyssen and the Thyssen family and industrial group in 1924. Just as we looked at in For the Record segments 155 and 187, the heads of the Bormann Group now are the sons, in some cases sons-in-law, of top Nazi officials and also key German generals and SS generals. One wonders whether the same principle holds for members of the American group, whether the sons and descendants of some of the principal American contacts of the Bormann Group may very well also be some of the key functionaries of the group in its modern period. Recall that George Herbert Walker and Prescott Bush, the grandfather of George W. and the father of the former president and CIA director, very close to Nazi industry, and one of their companies, one of the companies they managed, the American branch of the Hamburg America line, a key element of the Bormann Group and also a key element of the Himmlerkreis, the Himmler circle of friends that had basically financed the day-to-day operations of the SS. And in light of George Bush Sr.'s many connections to Nazi elements, particularly through the Reinhard Gehlen ABN milieu that we've looked at so many times, this, by the way, discussed in For the Record segment 186, I wonder whether George W. is, in fact, the Bormann candidate. What we're going to do next is to review some of the SS and Third Reich plan for conquest using a corporatist plan for conquest. To make a long story short, German arms were used to subdue the neighboring nations, and then their wealth and their corporate structures were glommed onto the corporations of the Third Reich, which then used their accrued wealth, largely through or in part through not only patent control of patent technologies, but also through currency exchange manipulations and bank clearing procedures. The wealth of the Third Reich and its corporations grew, and basically the Third Reich's corporations were used as vehicles of national conquest, and this is basically the post-World War II tactic of what I call the Underground Reich, whereas American corporations are largely apolitical past a point once they have achieved of laxer environmental regulations and low labor costs, then basically they are apolitical. They do not function as a unified whole, and they do not function as coordinated vehicles of national conquest. On the other hand, German corporations do, and we're going to review that right now from For the Record program 102. In this particular broadcast is entitled Connecting the Dots, and in turn we're going to review information from the book The Splendid Blonde Beast by Christopher Simpson, published in soft cover by the Common Courage Press, copyright 1995. Now note again how the German corporations function in a corporatist plan for empire and conquest, and then we're going to take a look at how the SS basically utilized this particular concept, and this translated into the post-World War II Bormann Group. Again, this is from For the Record Program 102.
In contrast, much of the banking and industrial elite of Germany favored a more traditional, imperial approach to acquiring a new empire in Europe. Among their principal spokesmen were Economics Minister Hjalmar Schacht, Hermann Abs, in parentheses, whom we just heard about, and a young Reichsbank director, Karl Blessing. Their strategy favored integrating businesses in countries occupied by the Germans into private industrial syndicates coordinated through German-based cartels and through private institutions such as Deutsche Bank. The private companies, in turn, pledged their loyalty to Hitler's government. German military conquest should be used to create conditions through which German corporations could buy up the key enterprises in newly subjugated countries at very favorable prices, this faction contended, but only in rare instances should the state take direct command of industry. Much of the senior leadership of the Deutsche Bank, IG Farben, the Siemens Group of Companies, and other German-based cartels maintained that Germany should re-enter the world marketplace rather than attempt to build up the orthodox Nazi dream of a self-sufficient German empire in Central and Eastern Europe. And reprising yet another segment of The Splendid Blonde Beast that we looked at in the tides of 20th century capital flow, these corporatists dominated the German industrial and financial elite that supported Hitler, the German end of this transatlantic financial and industrial axis, and as we shall see, they were inextricably linked, or I should say heavily involved with the SS, through the Himmlerkreis, or Himmler Circle of Friends. We looked at this in Uncle Sam and the Swastika, and the Uncle Sam and the Swastika archive show the Himmler Circle of Friends was a group of industrialists and financiers who supported the SS and financed the SS's daily operations. In exchange, they got the pick of the SS slave labor pool, and they worked very closely with the SS and coordinated their policies with them. Now note, as the Third Reich's fortunes began to decline, these corporatists, working in conjunction with the SS-connected industrialists of the Himmlerkreis, were the point element that was preparing contingency plans for Nazi defeat. And as such, these were the main elements working with people like William Draper in the war's wake, and they were the, again, the German end of this transatlantic financial and industrial axis, and thanks to the efforts of their American counterparts, were put right back in power after World War II. Turning once again to the Splendid Blonde Beast, we read of these corporatists connected with the Himmlerkreis and the SS. The notorious Himmlerkreis, the Circle of Friends of Reichsfuhrer SS Heinrich Himmler, is a good example of the dynamics of Germany's high-level business networks during the decline of the Third Reich. The Nazis and leading German businessmen had jointly created the Himmlerkreis in the early 1930s as an informal communication link between the financial and industrial elite and the SS. Himmler sought the political and economic support of the business elite, and the elite in turn sought influence outside of official channels with the increasingly powerful police leader. Senior business leaders active in the Himmlerkreis included Siemens General Director Rudolf Bingel, Unilever and Continental Oil Director Karl Blessing, steel industrialist Friedrich Fleck, by the way, whom we just heard about, who was the beneficiary of Dylan Reed's efforts, continuing, Dresdner Bank's Karl Rasche and Emil Meyer, shipping and oil executive Karl Lindemann, and board members or senior managers from the Deutsche Bank, RKG, IG Farben, Krupp, and a dozen other companies central to the German economy. As the SS grew as an economic power, the SS members of the Himmlerkreis often migrated to new positions on corporate boards where they could secure government contracts and embody corporate loyalty to the regime. SS men and Nazi Party activists who made this transition included Wilhelm Kepler of the Braybag Brown Coal Combine and SS Enterprises, Fritz Kronefuss of Braybag, Dresdner Bank, and Ritter von Halt, who joined the Deutsche Bank board. Officially, the Himmlerkreis meetings were not for conducting business because that would have suggested corruption in National Socialist circles. As a practical matter, however, the encounters served as an informal coordinating point for German industry's negotiations with the SS on policy matters. I.G. Farben appears to have used Himmlerkreis meetings to seek support for the company's vast forced labor complex at Auschwitz, for example. The companies represented in Himmler's circle became pacesetters in Aryanization, exploitation of concentration camp labor, seizure of foreign companies in the occupied territories, and similar business ventures that depended on SS cooperation. But as the war turned against the Third Reich, a number of business leaders in the Himmlerkreis began to cooperate in clandestine and semi-clandestine contingency planning for the post-war period. Two of the best-known of these groups, the Working Group for Foreign Economic Questions and the Kleine Arbeitskreis, or Small Working Group, were nominally sponsored by the Reichsgruppe Industry Association of Major Industrial and Financial Companies. Christopher Simpson then goes on to name a number of the key players in this Himmlerkreis-connected group of industrialists and financiers, again part of the corporate faction that we heard about just a few minutes ago. And as we shall see, this group is instrumental in working with the American end of the transatlantic financial and industrial axis to retain the position of the German industrial and financial elite at the end of World War II. Note in particular the name of Ludwig Erhard. He was Konrad Adenauer's economics minister, the chief architect of German economic reconstruction at the end of World War II, and later became Chancellor of Germany, and he's one of the key SS-connected industrialists that we're about to hear about. Returning once again to the splendid blonde beast by Simpson, of this group we read, "They brought together Blessing, Rasche, Kurt von Schroeder, Lindemann, and others from the Himmlerkreis, with other business people such as Hermann Obst of the Deutsche Bank, Ludwig Erhard, then an economist with the Reichsgruppe Industry and later Konrad Adenauer's most important economic advisor, Ludger Westrich of RKG Aluminum Industry and Non-Ferrous Metals, Philip Rienstma of Tobacco, Shipping and Banking, and with Nazi business specialists such as Otto Ohlendorf, the former commander of the Einsatzgruppe D murder troops, and Hans Kerl, the SS business specialist. A half dozen similar business forums emerged during the last years of the Third Reich. Most of these overlapped in membership, and all of them favored some variation of the corporatist strategy for empire articulated by Hjalmar Schacht, Obs, and others during the showdown over Aryanization in Vienna discussed earlier."
Bearing in mind, of course, that the Himmlerkreis was the Himmler's circle of friends, we're going to turn to a book that I've accessed many times. It's called Serpent's Walk. It's a Nazi tract published by National Vanguard Books, the publishing arm of the National Alliance. It's authored by someone who writes under the name of Randolph D. Calverhall. It's about a Nazi takeover in the mid-21st century by the descendants of the SS who go underground, build up a huge economic organization that buys into the American opinion-forming media, and then they take over the United States. This is discussed on the back cover, and it speaks of Serpent's Walk as follows. "It assumes that Hitler's warrior elite, the SS, didn't give up their struggle for a white world when they lost the Second World War. Instead, their survivors went underground and adopted some of the tactics of their enemies. They began building their economic muscle and buying into the opinion-forming media. A century after the war, they are ready to challenge the Democrats and Jews for the hearts and minds of white Americans who have begun to have their fill of government-enforced multiculturalism and, quote, equality, unquote." And again, that book, very familiar to members of the listening audience, I believe to be far more than the novel it purports to be. I believe, like the Turner Diaries put out by the same publisher, it's a blueprint, a manifesto of what the Nazi faithful are going to be doing. And in a discussion between two of the Nazis in this, quote, novel, unquote, the SS and their corporatist strategy for conquest are described as follows. The SS, what was left of it, had business objectives before and during World War II. When the war was lost, they just kept on, but from other places, Bogota, Asunción, Buenos Aires, Rio de Janeiro, Mexico City, Colombo, Damascus, Dhaka, you name it. They realized that the world is heading toward a corporocracy, 5 or 10 international super companies that will run everything worth running by the year 2100. Those super corporations exist now, and they're already dividing up the production and marketing of food, transport, steel and heavy industry, oil, the media, and other commodities. They're mostly conglomerates with fingers in more than one pie. Skipping down, we, the SS, have the say in 4 or 5. We've been competing for the past 60 years or so, and we're slowly gaining. And skipping down about the taking over of the American media, the book writes, about 10 years ago, we swung a merger, a takeover, and got voting control of a super corporation that runs a small but significant chunk of the American media. not openly with bands and trumpets or swastikas flying, but quietly. One huge corporation cuddling up to another one and gently munching it up like a great gubbing amoeba. And again, they use this to change American public opinion, invading and denying the Holocaust and eventually persuading the American opinion, the American public, to that persuasion. I discussed that in the first half hour of this particular program. As one watches these super corporations forming and then gently cuddling up to one another, note the Bertelsmann participation in both Time Warner and AOL, which have just, basically AOL has just gobbled up Time Warner. Note also that Holocaust revisionism is very much the order of the day. The New York Times of Wednesday, January 12th, has the following story by Sarah Lyall, L-Y-A-L-L. It's datelined London, January 11th, and headlined, London Trial Opens Dispute on Rewriting Holocaust. It's about a libel suit filed in London, or in England, by David Irving. Skipping down, Mr. Irving, who has said, among other things, that Hitler did not approve the mass killing of Jews during the war and that Auschwitz was merely a brutal labor camp with an unfortunately high death rate, is suing Deborah Lipstadt, the author of Denying the Holocaust, The Growing Assault on Truth and Memory, unquote, and her British publisher, Penguin. And then another article about that very same lawsuit was carried in the Los Angeles Times of Friday, January 7th of the year 2000. This is an article by Kim Murphy, and it's headlined, Danger in Denying Holocaust, subtitled, A Revisionist is Accusing a Prominent Critic of the Movement of Libel. Scholars and survivors say the evidence is irrefutable, but those who question the extent of the horrors say they pay a price. And skipping down, there's an interesting detail, and dovetail this with the reaction of some Harvard students to the documentary about Holocaust revisionist Fred Luchter that we talked about in our first half hour. Skipping down on this L.A. Times story from 1-7-2000, the revisionists, whose theories will be at the center of a high-profile libel trial scheduled to begin Tuesday in London, are not operating in a vacuum. A 1993 poll by the Roper Organization found that 22% of Americans thought it possible that the Holocaust never happened. And if corporations like Bertelsmann, bearing in mind that Dirk Bovendom, their official historian, has written in 1984 and in 1993 that Roosevelt was responsible, and Roosevelt and the Jews who control the American media basically bore the blame for World War II, as did the United States. So Serpent's Walk may very well become a reality if things continue as they have been. That concludes this broadcast. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.